From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, public radio stations across the country are collaborating in a project called Whose Democracy Is It? Since the whole enterprise of democracy depends on an informed electorate, we decided to spend this hour on the state of play between media and democracy in 2003. Abraham Lincoln once said, "Let the people know the facts and the country will be safe." So that's what we're asking today. Are the facts out there? And if not, why not?
Scott Armstrong is an investigative reporter who has served as liaison between journalists and government groups on the issue of leaks. He sees a serious blockage in the information flow, and he joins me now. Scott, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So Thomas Jefferson once said, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." I mean, come on, he wasn't serious, was he?
Well, he was quite serious. And in fact, from the very founding of our country, the relationship between the newspapers and the Congress was symbiotic. The newspapers originally published what the Congress did as their official records, and they published what they thought of it.
And what were the respective roles of the media and the Congress?
Well, as time developed, the media became essentially the hammer that would use Congress as an anvil to beat points out and say, this is what is going on, and Congress would then examine it. On other occasions, the Congress became the hammer, and the media would be an anvil. But there was always a relationship of one being able to strike the other and be able to shape the public understanding of things. Woodrow Wilson in 1885 said that the Congress's primary function is to inform the public, not to legislate, that informing was much more fundamental than legislating.
So how are the anvil and the hammer proceeding today? Flash forward to 2003.
Well, right now we're swinging the media hammer and it's just flying through the air. It's not hitting anything. The Congress isn't there.
Can you give me an example of how this symbiosis has fallen apart?
Well, the example that we're now suffering through at length is Ambassador Wilson, who had been asked by the administration to go to Africa to find out if the Iraqis were trying to purchase yellow cake uranium from Niger. He had come back and reported that they weren't privately. And when the administration ignored it and went to war, he made his trip known publicly. We're now stuck on the notion that somebody in the administration revealed the fact that Wilson is married to a CIA official, and there's now an FBI investigation going on at the request of the CIA for the leak of that information. And yet, we don't have Congress going back and concentrating on the fundamental question, which is why the administration went after Wilson in the first place, which is that the premise for the war, the premise for saying that Saddam was a nuclear threat, was an incorrect premise. That was known as early as September of 2002. Congress knew it in March of 2003 and, in fact, asked questions about it, but never bothered to have hearings. They just took a pass on it, and they still are taking a pass on it today. Congress is not setting things up. They're not beginning to have hearings on important issues.
And so with Congress then refusing to run with the clues provided earlier in the year about the uranium story, did the media end up somehow overstepping its role in order to fill the gap?
What happens is when you don't have a public forum, when you don't have either a congressional committee or you don't have people who have the ability to get information and put it out publicly, when you don't have that anvil, the media is insecure. It feels that it's not able to pin it down. It's looking for other people to take the responsibility, as well it should, but it's not able to go out and get the sources itself, and so it writes it in a very namby-pamby way. It's a fundamental change in the way the media's role has developed in our democracy.
Is it the political climate or this particular administration or merely the fact that the Republicans control the presidency in both houses or a combination of all those things?
Going back to sometime in the Reagan administration, I would say there's been a kind of consistent belief that if they just simply hold back facts, depriving the press of the basic information it needs to go begin to do reporting, and the press has to just fight for that information, that the press won't have time left over to actually go probe these things and find out if they're really true. And that's basically proven to be an accurate assumption. They've begun to manipulate by simply raising the cost of doing business. Secrecy compounds this. If information is the currency of democracy, secrecy allows you to print counterfeit currency. And that's what's happened. We have things like this weapons of mass destruction thing that are built on counterfeit currency. And so that's a change, and it's arrived to us kind of mechanically. The same people through a couple of administrations, the Clinton administration did some of the same things, but they didn't raise the barrier to basic information quite as high as this administration has. For the first time since the founding of the Defense Department, they took the regulations that control the Defense Department and made them unavailable to reporters, the public, or anyone else. They'd always been available. You could get them on websites. And they told you how things were supposed to happen in the military. They took them and they made them for official use only. We can still get them if you go to a lot of effort. But they're just not there to refer to say, is this being done right? What is it that's supposed to happen next?
And the desperate scramble after fewer facts means that the facts are not as scrupulously checked and not as reliable?
Well, these days, I think it's become the standard of reporting that if you can find out what the Defense Department or the White House or the State Department say they're doing, that that's called real reporting. In the old days, that wasn't considered reporting at all. That was the work of a scribe. That's where you started before you went out and did your reporting. These days, to just get that information becomes an effort. Every administration tries it to some extent, but this Congress has just sat back and let the administration go, and that's got to stop.
Well, how then, Scott? How does it stop?
It stops when a committee chairman says, I insist that the secretary come here and I'm going to ask him these questions publicly and we're not going to go into executive session and you have to explain to us why you're not going to give us this information. And gradually, that kind of pressure, very much like the British system where you have a question hour where there's a confrontation between the parliament and the administration, is what finally gets you answers because they can't stand that kind of scrutiny over time. And if they won't give it, then you start putting on other witnesses who do give it to you until finally you get a complete picture. It's just hard work. And the media itself has to stand up and say, look, you're making us do your job. We cannot be the only fact finder here. You have to advance the facts. It's only when you have that three-way intersection between the executive branch, the legislature, and the media that the public is really truly informed.
Okay. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brooke.
Scott Armstrong is a Washington journalist and founder of the National Security Archive.
Fathers of Nobel Prize winners were rounded up by United Nations military units, all right, and actually forced at gunpoint to give semen samples in little plastic jars, which are now stored below Rockefeller Center underneath the ice skating rink. We want to be there for the thaw.
Ugh.
I mean, it's disgusting. You know what they put in the water, don't you? Fluoride. Yeah, fluoride. On the pretext that it strengthens your teeth. That's ridiculous. You know what this stuff does to you? It actually weakens your will, takes away the capacity for free and creative thought, and makes you a slave to the state.
When the usual mechanisms, media and Congress, for instance, malfunction and fail to adequately inform the public, sometimes citizens take it upon themselves to find the answers. Conspiracy theory has a long tradition as a popular entertainment, for instance, the belief that the moonwalk was faked in a studio, but anthropologist George Marcus of Rice University isn't interested in fringe theorists. He's fascinated by those times when conspiracy theory is taken up by reasonable people to explain real events, when the official explanation just doesn't hold together.
It's up to the individual citizen to figure out why the Californians are paying more for energy, or why we're in Iraq. And I believe that these basic questions that are with us from day to day and actually have long-term consequences for every one of us and shape our lives require the kind of speculation that conspiracy thinking gives rise to.
But don't you think the media are supposed to be explaining these things?
The media are. But when the media is doing its job in unveiling scandal or questioning the reasons of power, be it private or public, and the answers are not totally clear. People are not just going to leave things as puzzles. They're going to speculate. I don't consider conspiracy theories within this frame of reason or plausibility to be a bad thing at all. I consider it to be one aspect of the right of a democratic citizenry to question or figure out the exercise of power. I consider a little bit of paranoia within reason to be a valuable thing.
Are you suggesting then that perhaps conspiracy theory and the media can nudge each other along? For instance, the conspiracy theory about the control of energy to push up prices in California preceded the actual investigation that suggests that that scenario is actually true. There are a lot of theories about the fall of the Allende regime in Chile, which subsequent investigation turned out to be true. Is there some sort of give and take here?
Oh, absolutely. I think that one enhances the other and that both have a role to play in the functioning of democracy in difficult times.
And is this a difficult time?
Extraordinarily. Well, take the current moment. There is a war going on against hard-to-detect forces that could harm us all, as stunningly initiated by the World Trade Center destruction. And the media is following this and reporting it. But it's all about a secret world of the exercise of power, for which our civil rights have to be qualified or changed so that this work can proceed. And increasingly, as we move away from the World Trade Center, people are becoming very critical and suspicious of their government in the United States. And it seems to me that the media is doing what it can to cover this story. But it is creating as many questions as answers. So by informing, it's fueling a period of uncertainty. But what else could it do? It's doing what it can do.
Professor Marcus, thank you very much.
Thank you.
George Marcus is a professor of anthropology at Rice University and editor of Paranoia Within Reason, a casebook on conspiracy as explanation.
Coming up, why local TV is practically apolitical and the media's use and abuse of polls.
This week's show is part of Public Radio's special coverage, Whose Democracy Is It? You're listening to On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In two recent poll results of note, USA Today declared that General Wesley Clark would defeat President Bush in a head-to-head presidential matchup. Also, in an online survey by the website Mr. Poll, 26% said Britney Spears would be most likely, among a list of female celebrities, to keep a man as a slave. What was notable about those results is that neither is true, for reasons I'll get to shortly. For the moment, let's just agree that we as a society are awash in polls, giving our leaders and us as citizens an unprecedented amount of data about our thoughts, our beliefs, our aspirations. And plenty of those data, as reported by the media, are simply wrong.
We would rather be lashed in reporting return than to be wrong. If we say somebody has carried a state, you can pretty much take it to the bank.
The congressman listening to that replay of Dan Rather's infamous Election 2000 boast about exit poll accuracy found the memory very funny. But it didn't seem so hilarious at the time, especially to the network-anointed winner, Al Gore. Still, Correction 2000 hasn't slowed the polling industry down any. Gallup, Roper, Zogby, Lou Harris, ABC, NBC, CBS, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, USA Today, they're all out there asking questions about what seems to be on America's mind. This can include everything from our approval of the president's performance to our least favorite food, liver, to any number of questions America couldn't possibly know the answer to.
Suzanne Malveaux at the White House. Suzanne, thanks very much for that report. And to our viewers, here's your turn to weigh in on this story. Our web question of the day is this. Is Saddam Hussein still in Iraq or in another country? You can vote right now. Go to CNN.com/Wolf. I'm anxious to hear what you have to say. We'll have the results later in this broadcast.
And certainly, I'd tell you how the vote came out, but what would be the point? For one thing, as with the Mr. Poll speculation about the bondage proclivities of female celebrities, who would have any earthly idea where Saddam Hussein is? And because the sample of online respondents is self-selecting, not random, the tally tells us zero about what America at large thinks about the subject. Yet every time you turn on the TV, it seems there's Wolf Blitzer or Bill O'Reilly or your local anchor asking you to register your vote online. Betsy Martin is president of the American Association for Public Opinion Research.
They're really completely meaningless. I think they're really marketing gimmicks. I mean, it's entertainment, but it doesn't say anything about public opinion.
Now, a lot of media outlets will say this is non-scientific. We, of course, say, well, why put it on if it's non-scientific?
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll.
Well, the reason they put it on is that consultants tell them that that gets viewer involvement and increases ratings. But we don't like it because it confuses the public. That's bad.
In the case of online polls, the media parlor game constitutes journalistic fraud. But through inattention or worse, the media can also be complicit in misleading the public about poll results obtained with statistical rigor, but which nonetheless are dangerously misleading.
Not only can polls be used to spin an idea, they are quite often used to spin an idea, to spin a proposition, and sometimes are even created to spin a proposition.
Former Republican pollster Frank Luntz is now host of MSNBC's America's Voices.
There are certain pollsters on both the Republican and Democratic side who are known to be in bed with their parties, who are known to twist and turn data to make it show whatever their political parties want it to show, because they're being paid by their political parties to make it show what they want it to show. And the amazing thing is that the news media still reports it.
Luntz should know he was censured 5 years ago by the American Association for Public Opinion Research for spinning his polls on behalf of the GOP. And such behavior, according to Jim Norman, polling editor at USA Today, is both commonplace and easy to accomplish, with leading language, cunning choice of background information, or just an inflammatory word or phrase.
Tax and spend liberal, a phrase like that can automatically cause skewing of a question. Proponents of causes know this and use this to get the kind of poll results they want.
But there needn't be mischief afoot for the public to be misled by a poll result. Consider that USA Today story about the showdown between Wesley Clark and the president. The same story that declared Clark ahead by 2 points also stated the margin of error as 4 points, which means, statistically speaking, that nobody is ahead. It's a dead heat, too close to call. This isn't just a statistical technicality. It's the heart of the meaning of poll numbers, yet it's routinely tossed off as boilerplate. John Zogby is the founder and president of Zogby Polling.
I don't think that a lot of the reporters out there understand what the meaning of margin of sampling error is. I think it's perfunctorily reported. It's the sort of thing that you devote the last second and a half to. The margin of sampling error is plus or minus 3. I think that was a second and a half.
But basic ignorance of or inattention to the underlying science leads to bad reporting. For instance, Zogby's own organization recently was rebuked by the National Council of Public Polls for misrepresenting as scientific a poll of 600 Iraqis, the results of which suggested long-term optimism among 70% of the Iraqi population. The rebuke, however, came after the story in the Washington Times, which relied on the poll data and was headlined, "Iraq, Better Than You Think." There's yet one more issue to consider. How much do we even want our politicians to track our opinion and govern around it? The columnist Walter Lippmann considered routine polling to be a cynical, opportunistic abrogation of political responsibility, a perversion of representative democracy that he said was causing the, quote, catastrophic decline of Western society. and Lipman never even heard of Britney Spears.
Some people argue that we elect representatives, and those representatives should there go off and be brilliant.
Frank Newport of the Gallup Organization.
You know, in a democracy, the people are the source of wisdom and ultimate power, and I would like my elected representative to poll all the time, trying to understand that wisdom of the people.
Certainly, politicians ignore public opinion at their own peril. It has swept the likes of Mussolini and Robespierre into power, only later to send them to the executioner. Public opinion about slavery inflamed the North, even as public opinion about states' rights emboldened the South. Public opinion killed Nicolae Ceaușescu and spared Captain Dreyfus and Barabbas. The very public outrage that lured us into the Spanish-American War extricated us, ultimately, from Vietnam. While there's always the risk of political power being too heavily invested in the wisdom of the people, think California, clearly elected officials must keep their finger on the pulse of public opinion. But they cannot do so without the honest brokership of the media, who owe it to us to present an actual pulse point, and not just the soothing vibration of some scoundrel or fool running off at the mouth.
Several reliable polls suggest that for most Americans, local television newscasts are a prime source for news about their communities. But is it a good source for information on local politics and government? One recent study suggests maybe not. The University of Wisconsin and the Lear Center at the University of Southern California found that in the weeks leading up to the 2002 elections, in the top 50 TV markets, 56% of local TV newscasts didn't air a single story on any campaign. OTM's Paul Ingalls reports on why some news departments steer away from political coverage, while others push themselves to break new ground on the subject.
What this isn't is a typical day on the campaign trail.
During the 2002 election season, Wisconsin Public Television's Jerry Huffman anchored a series of reports showing what happened when the candidates for governor allowed the TV station to temporarily take control of their campaign schedules.
Instead of a day of choreographed events and bust-in supporters, the seven gubernatorial candidates have agreed to follow us all over Wisconsin to meet one-on-one with voters.
The series earned a Lear Center Walter Cronkite Award for news producer Andy Moore. In an interview with the Lear Center, Moore said at first some of the candidates resisted this stab at political reality TV, but when some agreed, the others signed on for the ride into the unknown.
They were extremely uncomfortable. Some of them handled it better than others. And the more uncomfortable they felt, the better job I felt that we were doing.
The Wisconsin Public Television effort stood out amid a local TV news landscape where truly innovative reporting on local politics and government is rare.
News about our democracy is being pushed out of the way by a concern about live, local, late-breaking coverage, which so often is about crime.
That's former CBS producer Wally Dean, who helped conduct a 5-year study of local commercial TV news content for the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which found, to no one's surprise, 60% of lead stories were about crime, disasters, catastrophes, accidents, unusual weather. In other words, anything that might include an emergency vehicle. Dean says stories on politics and government account for just 10% of local newscasts. Because, he says, news managers believe, or are told by their consultants, that politics is boring to viewers, and that police tape and flashing lights are eyeball grabbers. However, Dean's research also says if done well, political reporting can still help stations win.
And we found that stations who have the best ratings and share retention from their lead-in programming actually run more political and business stories. They can survive and not run yellow police tape, but we've got to convince them. That's why we spend so much time working with data, because we have to be able to take the data to them and say, look, you don't have to take our word for it.
Still, many news managers find local civic and political stories too complex or specialized to appeal to the broadest audience the way crime reports can. Karen Foss has anchored news at KSDK in St. Louis for over 20 years and appeared with Wally Dean on a panel on local news held in Albuquerque in September. She says her station tries hard not to overdo crime coverage and to sometimes tell the more detailed political story. But when they do, they often get the call the next day.
Those who are the consultants and the analysts sit down and look at minute by minute where the viewers have been. They will say, last night that story ran 4 minutes and 20% of our audience left. And it really, there'll be no reflection on whether that was an important 4 minute story.
Foss says the electronic meters hooked directly into TV sets that count audience in such detail in larger markets like hers are one factor that could be reducing civic reporting. In medium and small markets, ratings are usually drawn from old-style written diaries that can't single out a 4 minute report on local government as a viewer loser. It may, in fact, draw viewers, says Susanna Schuler, news chief of Nexstar Broadcasting, which operates 25 medium and small market stations. She says people tend to be more active in local government in smaller communities, and therefore more interested in seeing such stories on the local news. Just how interested they are remains a mystery to local news managers.
We tend to be more civic-minded than our viewers, but sometimes we don't know if that's good or bad. If that means they are or they would be if we just gave them more coverage, or if they're saying, I don't care about that stuff. Go tell me about the traffic accidents and the, you know, the fires and the piddly little stuff that we think, you know, who does that affect? Not many.
Schuler, Foss, and many local news directors, surveyed by the Local TV News Project last year, say they don't have enough reporters to cover the news of the day in their market, much less to do investigative reporting about politics and civic issues. Critics of local TV news say shrinking staffs are a result of increasingly consolidated corporate ownership, cutting back to keep profit margins high. They ask, why not settle for slightly less profit in the name of the public interest?
You can't go to Wall Street and say, well, now we're only going to make this much. Are you still going to support us?
Susanna Schuler of Nexstar.
You would have to get the entire industry on board to change that, and I don't see that happening.
So if getting more reporters isn't likely, the challenge then becomes how to do effective political and civic reporting on a shoestring. USC's Lear Center insists it can be done, so its annual awards acknowledge the best practices in reporting staples like candidate profiles, pieces exploring voters' concerns, and stories that check claims in debates or candidate and issue ads, like this report from King TV in Seattle.
Watch the commercials for Referendum 51, and you'd think this vote is all about your safety. Reality check?
And how about a new approach to candidate debates? Again, Wisconsin Public TV was noted for breaking the mold by staging a gubernatorial forum that did away with the usual conventions, podiums, moderators, timed responses, and instead put the candidates around a small table to talk to each other with no rules, forcing them off their usual scripted remarks. Although news producer Andy Moore feels any local station could try their experiment, he says it's tough to convince candidates to try anything out of the ordinary. Susanna Schuler of Nexstar would agree.
We have offered free time in some of our markets that candidates have refused to take because they're not sure they know how to control the message. The politicians want to talk about one thing, and many times our news operations want them to talk about something else. And so there becomes a disconnect, and we get tired of going to the dog and pony show when we don't find value for our viewers.
Jill Geisler is on the faculty of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, which trains professional journalists. She says one way to deepen coverage of local democracy in action is for television newsrooms to recommit to beat reporting, assigning a reporter to cover City Hall, the State House, or the congressional delegation, and not pulling them so often to cover breaking news.
When you walk the halls of power, you frequently see what I would call anticipatory journalism. It's the tip that someone gives you about an idea that could become a proposition, that could become a bill, that could become a law. And you as a reporter are telling that story to people at a time when something can still be done about it.
In the long run, says Geisler, the news story content mix, particularly on local commercial news programs, rests in the hands of the viewers, who can vote with their remotes, by clicking to and staying with stations offering serious coverage of local issues and politics. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
Now for a few of your letters. My interview with newly appointed New York Times public editor Daniel Okrent prompted this from Times reporter Richard Perez Reyna. You were very much mistaken when you said that a recorded message was all a person could expect when calling to respond to things in the New York Times. People reach me every day by phone and by email to respond to the articles I've written. I also object to the statement that with the addition of a public editor, there's now someone whose job it is to respond to readers. There always was someone whose job it was. Me, my fellow reporters, my editors, all of us. And it will remain our job, public editor or no public editor.
Lou Mayer of Seattle was struck by my interview with typeface designer Matthew Carter, who said no when I asked him if he'd ever flaunted his status as inventor of the font Verdana to pick up women in bars. Mayer wrote, "I, too, am a font designer, and I have tried to use my vocation as an opening line with women I meet in bars, telling them of the fonts I've designed. Unfortunately, they just look at me and then say, 'You're not my type.'"
Finally, several listeners were quick to correct us about the director of the movie Cider House Rules mentioned in last week's zombie piece. As Steve Zemke of New York pointed out, it was Lasse Hallström, not Sam Raimi, who directed the film. We're always eager to hear your comments and your corrections. Write to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, the seductive power of C-SPAN. Also, when it comes to TV, which do you prefer, freedom or fairness?
This week's show is part of Public Radio's special coverage, Whose Democracy Is It? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. C-SPAN has been cablecasting the U.S. House of Representatives since 1979. Today, it operates three channels and airs unedited public events, call-ins, book talks, and so forth. Yet, it's not as ubiquitous as it once was because competition for space on the limited digital bandwidth is tight. Some cable systems that used to provide C-SPAN as a free public service are now dropping one or all of the C-SPAN channels in favor of revenue-earning fare, the significance of which depends on your appetite for fly-on-the-wall programming. Here's The Daily Show's Jon Stewart.
C-SPAN, for those of you with sex lives, is 24-hour coverage of your government in all its visual splendor. I've actually sucked my hotel minibar all the way down to the Freon, thanks to 72 hours of this.
Mrs. Boxer, Mr. Bro, Mr. Brownback, Mr. Bunny, Mr. Burns, Mr. Bird.
But for its devoted followers, C-SPAN is more than a fly on the wall. It is a tool of democracy. Paul Miller is a member of Citizens for C-SPAN.
C-SPAN enables people to learn about not simply the outcomes of government decisions, but the processes of government at work, to see for themselves how decisions are made, the expressions on the faces of the people making the decisions and their tones of voice. This ability to see the primary source in action is absolutely essential for people to understand the processes of their government.
Who are the citizens for C-SPAN, and are they armed?
Well, we're not armed, not yet in any case. We are simply citizens from all over the country who believe very strongly in having access to government and democracy on TV. The organization was actually founded in Seattle in 1997, following a decision by the cable company there to cut access to C-SPAN. The organization started up to very successfully fight that cutback and quickly grew into a national organization that has been helping other communities to fight cutbacks in C-SPAN.
Tell me about the 1996 Cable Act. That changed the so-called must-carry rules. Did that affect C-SPAN's carriage across the country?
Sort of the background of this is that for a long time, the FCC has required cable operators to carry local programmer stations. But with the advent of digital television, the FCC under the 1996 Cable Act now requires cable companies to carry not only the analog signal on the regular channel from local broadcasters, but also a digital signal. Essentially, the end impact for C-SPAN was that about 9 million viewers lost their access to C-SPAN when cable operators said that as a result of the requirements of this act, they no longer had space for C-SPAN.
Now, there are still more than 80 million people who have C-SPAN on their cable systems. That doesn't necessarily mean that 80 million people are watching. Do you have any idea how many people actually look at this fairly, well, I don't think I'm being pejorative here, bland programming?
Well, indeed, that's one of the misconceptions we'd very much like to dispel about C-SPAN. But since C-SPAN is a non-commercial station or network, it does not participate in Nielsen's. But what limited research has been done by Nielsen indicates that about 28 million viewers tune into C-SPAN every week, which is a large number of viewers when you compare to, say, 17 million for a very popular network series like The West Wing. But I think this is one of the great misconceptions of C-SPAN is that C-SPAN is dull or bland. And in fact, people who know C-SPAN well know that because it's a primary source of programming, the C-SPAN camera truly never blinks. And so C-SPAN often has been called the ultimate reality TV. Hang out and pay attention for a little while and you'll see the most amazing, unpredictable, and unexpected things happen.
I guess that's true, but you can also do that by standing on a street corner. Eventually, some car is going to run into a light post.
Amazing things can happen. One episode that got a fair amount of notice recently was this encounter or sort of a showdown between Bill O'Reilly and Al Franken.
No,
hey, shut up.
No,
you had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
This isn't
this
your
is
show,
what this guy
Bill.
Does.
Bill,
this is
you
what
can
he
tell
does.
Me. You can't tell.
This is what he
Take
does.
Take control, Pat. Come on.
I think, wait a minute. I think I need a whistle in a striped shirt.
President Reagan, during his presidency, on occasion called in and just on the viewer call-in line to express some opinions about some things he had seen going on C-SPAN. Last week, the entertainer Cher called in. And
I just can't even imagine how that must have sounded.
But in some cases, these boys had lost one leg and the other leg was so damaged that they weren't sure what they were going to be able to do.
Where did you spend the day?
Walter Reed.
What were you doing at Walter Reed? Are you a volunteer? Or?
I'm an entertainer.
Oh, what kind of entertaining? Are you USO?
No, I actually was called by the USO, but I'm an entertainer. I don't want to go much past that. But
is this Cher?
Yeah.
Okay.
Tell me about what success you've had so far in getting C-SPAN back on cable systems where it was an endangered species.
Around the country, over the past several years, from Freeport, Maine to Santa Rosa to Texas to all over the place, a number of different communities have had great success in using essentially the model we recommend, which is to be very persistent in calling and organizing people to call their cable companies, lobby their public officials, and insist on the basic principle that public affairs programming is an essential public good.
Well, Paul, you're very kind to join us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Paul Miller, a marketing consultant from San Mateo, California, is the spokesman for Citizens for C-SPAN.
It's been a wild ride for the FCC this year. First, it voted to allow a company to own stations that reach up to 45% of TV households and to own both a newspaper and a TV station in the same market. Then, the Senate voted to repeal the new rules. Now that measure sits motionless in the House, and the president has threatened it with a veto if it passes. Oh, and there's also court action underway that challenges the new rules. So, it seems to be a stalemate, at least until the next legislative session. Enter New York Democrat Maurice Hinchey, who wants to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. He doesn't have a chance, but we thought we'd consider what's happened in the 15 years since the Fairness Doctrine vanished from the FCC rulebook. One of many rules devised to protect diversity, it required stations to address controversial issues and air a variety of viewpoints. But critics like Rush Limbaugh said it would quash voices like his. Joining me to discuss all this is Mark Fowler, FCC chairman under President Reagan, on the line from Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
And Andrew Schwartzman is president and CEO of the Media Access Project. Andy, welcome to you, too.
Hi, Brooke.
So when was the last time the two of you got together to debate the fairness doctrine?
I would imagine it would probably have been, Andy, in 1985, 86.
Probably.
Mark, it was a goal of your tenure at the FCC to get rid of the fairness doctrine.
Yes, that's right. We had this doctrine that basically said a broadcaster, when presenting issues of public importance, had to present all significant sides of that issue. Sounded great in theory. The problem is you had to have the government involved in deciding whether a broadcaster was, quote, fair in presenting particular issues of public importance. If you read the plain language of the First Amendment, the plain meaning of the language is pretty clear. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. And that plain language meant no.
Andy, what do you say to that?
The Supreme Court has held and repeatedly held that the purpose of the First Amendment is to promote informed debate so that the democratic process works optimally. And that sometimes means taking steps to promote the discussion of issues, which is what, as Mark described, the Fairness Doctrine does, a requirement that broadcasters cover controversial issues of importance in their community.
The printed press never had a Fairness Doctrine, never had the government looking at content to decide whether a publisher was fair or not, and it's worked very, very well. Moreover, I think it's unnecessary. We've got multitudes of voices in the marketplace today of ideas. We've got cable, satellites, radio, the internet, books, newspapers. We don't need a fairness doctrine. There's no need for the government to be involved, and the common man and common woman can decide for themselves out of this welter of voices and opinions what they believe and what they think is fair.
Andy, don't you trust the common man?
I trust the common man, but I also know that the common man is overwhelmingly influenced in how public opinion is shaped by newspapers and over-the-air television and, to a lesser degree, radio. That's the way that people decide for whom they're going to vote. The plethora of media voices out there that Mark talks about are not a plethora of influential media voices, nor are they a plethora of locally based voices. All of the cable channels, the internet is not a meaningful source of local news and opinion. Broadcasters are licensed to serve particular communities. Now, it's true that newspapers are not subject to the Fairness Doctrine, but newspapers are not licensed, and newspapers don't get free use of the public's airwaves and the public spectrum.
It seems that the chilling effect has been invoked both in favor of and against the Fairness Doctrine. Does the Fairness Doctrine have a chilling effect, Mark, or doesn't it?
Well, we demonstrated with a very thorough record at the FCC that we compiled that it did, because it got broadcasters into trouble sometimes when it was felt by some group or individual in a community that a particular broadcaster hadn't balanced it fairly, quote-unquote, and then they lodged a complaint with the FCC, and stations were threatened with revocation of their licenses. So it certainly had a chilling effect.
The more useful thing to look at is experience since 1987. What we have had happen in city after city after city is a loss of diversity because in most markets, typically one or two stations now do programming that involves discussion of issues. And the others, far from just no longer wanting to do controversy, are literally piping it in from the other side of the country, doing it in an automated way, and losing touch with their communities. We have much less dynamism, much less diversity, much less mixing it up, because not having to do controversy, most stations don't want to do controversy.
The talk radio community has said that people like Rush Limbaugh wouldn't have been allowed to exist under the Fairness Doctrine.
But nobody says that, including Mark, ever said that the Fairness Doctrine requires that a particular program or a particular host provide all the balance or that particular programs be internally balanced. The question is whether in the course of overall broadcast day there's some discussion of opposing points of view.
Great theory, Andy, and I know Andy believes this with all his heart, but the problem is that the government is the one that steps in and decides if it's fair or not, that broadcast station. That is not what the First Amendment says.
Andy, do you think that the market should be allowed to decide these things?
I think that the market is imperfect. That's why Congress had to pass a law saying that it's necessary to provide programming to meet the needs of children. Even Mark agreed that there was a marketplace failure in children, but on the same First Amendment theories that he talked about a moment ago. He didn't want to require that kind of programming. The marketplace is imperfect. It underserves the needs of those who are not commercially, demographically attractive to advertisers. And those are the people whose viewpoints and perspectives we need to hear about as well. So it diminishes the quality and nature of the democracy.
First Amendment doesn't say that everybody in an audience gets the right to speak. It doesn't mean that everybody at a town meeting has the right to get up or is able to voice their opinion. It's not perfect in that respect. But what the First Amendment does say is that the government is not in the auditorium trying to monitor the fairness or the unfairness of given speakers or the balance of the overall presentation. And I think you want a perfect world of what you call fair and balanced programming. And the problem, again, is you want the government to step in to assure that. And that's, I think, where we disagree.
One last question. Our program this week is about media and democracy. All in all, do we have a democratic broadcast system today?
Yes, we do. And a democratic society, I believe, Brooke, absolutely requires that the system be free. And again, that's what this whole discussion has been about. Fair is great, but free is the most important value when it comes to the electronic press and the marketplace of ideas. And that's with the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine honored.
I would say that we have the best system broadcasting in the world, and it has been because of, not in spite of, the system of regulation, including the Fairness Doctrine, that's operated since 1934. And unfortunately, I see the trend going in the wrong direction, and I see some of the luster of the system being worn off by deregulation. And the critical turning point in that was 1987 when the FCC repealed the Fairness Doctrine.
Okay. Andrew Schwartzman is the president and CEO of the Media Access Project, and he joined us from the NPR studios in Washington. Thanks, Andy.
This is more fun than I should have.
Mark Fowler was the chairman of the FCC from 1981 to 1987, and he joined us from his home in Florida. Thank you, too, Mark.
My pleasure, Brooke.
So, the Fairness Doctrine, probably not coming back, right?
Nope.
Want to unwind?
Yep.
Oh, hello there, Mr. Bob, Ms. Brooke. Haven't seen you guys for a while.
It's been busy.
So what'll it be? The usual?
Oh, why not? Brooke?
Sure.
There were waves in the air that were barely regulated. They were barely regulated. Broadcast was new.
Days of yore, 34, rules and regs were then enacted, but were almost all redacted. Bad luck for you.
And there were moguls and such concentration, it scared you, and mail deluged Capitol Hill. What a thrill! Were there balls on the hill standing up to oligarchy, saying no to their malarkey? It seems too few.
The FCC and broadcast lobby, let the foxes guard the hen house, which is great for Fox and Mickey Mouse, but not for you.
And then Clear Channel made Congress look so bad, it had to back up and leave some rules in place. Egon Face.
We had many licensees whose behavior we so hated. Behavior we so hated, till there was you.
Whose behavior we so hated, till there was you.
kids are good.
Views expressed in song do not necessarily represent the opinions of NPR, WNYC Radio, or the rest of the On the Media staff.
Yeah, I guess I feel better now. That's it for this week's show, which was part of Public Radio's special coverage, Whose Democracy Is It? On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, George Edwards, and Jennifer Munson. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball, Dave Goldberg, and John Dryden. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.